Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest in With Respect is Bob Myers. Bob is with the Historical Society of Michigan. We're going to find all about this great organization and about Bob's background in just a minute. He is a guest here. He's been a guest on our show before. And in fact, I think he was my second guest, if not first guest, on the beginning of With Respect back in the day. So, Bob Meyer, With Respect. Bob, how are you today?
I am fine, John. Yourself?
I am fantastic. It's a great day. I'm going to talk about my favorite subject, which is history, with a guy who really knows what history is all about and why it's fun. There are people out there, Bob, there are people out there, especially I've heard this so many times from kids in high school and grammar school, history is so boring, I can't stand it. But it's not. It's fascinating. How did you get into it?
Probably like most people did. When I was a kid, my dad, who loved history, would drag us around to museums and forts and historic sites like that. And he was just absolutely fascinated by it. And it just kind of rubbed off on me and became a lifelong passion.
So, track for me. Where are you from originally, and how did you get to where you're at now in the Historical Society of Michigan?
Well, that's a good question. Now, originally, I'm a native Michigander. I grew up in a little crossroads place called Fairview, which is, I always tell people, it's about halfway between Grayling and Alpena, and it's a blinker light, and that's about it. And but I went to college, Alma College, and then got out of college and started out 1,000 years ago as a curator at the Berrien County Historical Association in Berrien Springs. And I was there for many years and then got the chance to work for the Historical Society of Michigan. Okay. And moved up to Lansing, live in Grand Ledge now.
Well, tell me first of all about this, the Berrien County Historical Society, and what was its scope, and what did you see over the years you were there?
Well, that is the County Historical Association Society. It's in the old Courthouse Square in Berrien Springs, the original Berrien County Courthouse, Sheriff's House, County Office Building, and so I kind of started there when the organization was really just kind of getting going, and saw a lot of changes with that over the years, and a lot of changes developing in the historical interpretation of Berrien County, and that was really exciting, and hated to leave the area, but got a chance to work with a great organization here.
Well, just finishing up on Berrien County, we're talking about the county which is the southwesternmost county of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, which it borders on Lake Michigan and Indiana, and straight across the Lake Michigan from Chicago. So it's a place filled with a lot of small villages and moderate-sized towns, but it's got history, and your part in that, when you were first on my show, I don't know if you remember this, but we did a pastiche. We marched around verbally all of the little villages and towns around the village of Three Oaks, which was at that time the center point of our of my radio station. And
we
had a load of fun talking about how little places that maybe no one knows about had interesting things and interesting people who passed through and formed and shaped that particular area. But so you moved on from there. Oh, by the way, the courthouse there that you had your headquarters in was the original courthouse for Berrien County, which goes back to 1839, as I recall.
That's correct, yes.
And in fact, it's still, once a year or twice a year, there will be court proceedings will take place there just to make sure that everybody recognizes that this is a part of the real judicial system that has stretched over the 100-plus years of in Michigan history.
It's the oldest courthouse in Michigan. It's coming close now to its getting up to its 200th anniversary. It's bicentennial, so it goes back to it was built just 2 years after Michigan became a state.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes back to the very, very early statehood period of Michigan.
Well, all right, you moved on. You went up to the Historical Society of Michigan, and tell us about that.
Yeah, Historical Society of Michigan is Michigan's oldest cultural organization, believe it or not. It was founded back in, 1828 by Lewis Cass and Henry Schoolcraft. Lewis Cass was territorial governor, and they founded the Historical Society of Michigan, so it actually predates Michigan statehood,
mm-hmm.
and it has been active ever since. We're getting close to our, very close to our 200th anniversary at Historical Society of Michigan, and a lot of people mistake us, or confuse us, I should say, with the State Museum, Library, and Archives, which is run by the state of Michigan. And I always tell people, those are our very good friends. We love them, but that's not us. We are a private nonprofit, and a lot of people know us best because we publish Michigan History Magazine. That was a state publication for many, many years. And then during the economic downturn of 2008-2009, the state was going to discontinue the publication, and we picked it up then in 2009. So a lot of people know us best that way, but we do publications, conferences. We have three big conferences every year, educational programs. We do a lot of support work for historical organizations, societies, and so forth around the state. We run Michigan History Day, which is a part of National History Day, and that's a program for students grades 4th through 12th. So we do a lot of things that keep us busy.
You know, all right, you mentioned something which ties together what we started with, and that is you do educational programs for the young. How do you... I mean, do you go in and talk to these kids and say, "Oh, come on, kids! History is fun. Let's take let's start talking with 18. The first case was in 1822, and is that how you teach history?"
No. Well, one of the things that I love with Michigan History Day is that the students do the work themselves, and it's a voyage of discovery for them, and they find out how complicated history can be, how multifaceted it is, and they get to do their own work, and they can do it in a number of ways. They could do the traditional research paper, which we all hated and dreaded when we were in school. But they can also do a video documentary, kind of like Ken Burns' video documentary. They can do a website. They can do an exhibit, or they can do a performance. And the work that some of these kids they just knock your socks off. It's amazing what they do. I always come away from the competitions saying that I went to college, I went to grad school, I've got a master's degree in history, and I didn't know that. Sometimes I come back and I have to look stuff up and say, is that really true? Did that happen? Yeah, it did. And so the kids do some amazing work. And hopefully in the process of doing that, they find out that history is fun and that it's very challenging. And so I just love to see what they do.
You know, I've had experiences in my life, and I got the same treatment. My elders took me to battlefields, Gettysburg, Antietam, and in the Civil War, and other historical places. One of the things that intrigued me, and I guess it just caught me back in the back of my head, and I'm still passionate about it today, is once you go to one of these historical sites, especially with someone who knows what happened there, and or if you have done some research on your own. For example, one of the places that deeply affected me was going to see in Baltimore to see where the Star Spangled Banner was written and why it was written about the fort that the British were bombarding. And I stood there on the ramparts of the fort, and I thought, my God, people, this song, The Star Spangled Banner, is a graphic description of what was going on in this battle between the British warships pounding on the fort and the people holding out. And did the flag, did this giant flag that was hanging from the American fort, did it last through the night? And the song is all about that. And mm-hmm. In fact, oh, say, can you see, by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed? And they talk about this flag. It's stunning. It's scary. And in a sense, you're walking in the history, walking at the time when something like that happens. I've seen this. I've experienced this in other places. And I presume you have as well.
Yeah, doesn't it give you the chills?
It does give you the chills. I remember the first time I was at Gettysburg Battlefield, and I stood at various places where the Union and Confederate armies clashed. 200,000 people, men, women, fought in that battle, and thousands, tens of thousands died. And you could look across from Cemetery Ridge, over across the valley, and see where Pickett's charge and the last day of a 3-day battle started from the woods, and you can hear the bombs, the guns firing and the screaming and the flags and the it's very chilling. But at any rate, that's why I find history interesting. I also find it interesting when we talk about, for example, Native Americans and being in places where Native Americans were hundreds of years before the European colonists came in. So I just find it fascinating.
Yeah.
Well.
Yep, me too.
There's another part of our area, and I say now I'm talking about the Great Lakes area, which I'd like to talk about with you because you're an expert on it. And those
I don't know about that. I'd never claim to be an expert on maritime history. But.
Well, and those parts you're not an expert on, you can fake. All right.
I just make it up.
You make it up as you go along. All right. First of all, tell me about the Great Lakes in history, the history side of the Great Lakes. How do they fit in? How does history in the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan especially, come to in your crosshairs?
Yeah, well, so much of the history of this whole region is the Great Lakes. It's a water highway, among other things. I mean, it's a natural resource for fishing and so on and so forth and recreation today. But you know, it's a water highway. And I always told people when I was working in Berrien County, I told them, you know, how far could, if you were on the St. Joseph River, if you got on the St. Joseph River, how far could you go? And the answer is Europe. Hmm. And for people who lived in the region, especially after the Erie Canal was built in 1825 or completed in 1825, you could travel from the St. Joseph River all the way to Europe by water. You never had to put your feet on dry land. Mm-hmm. You could travel down the river to the harbor at St. Joseph, up Lake Michigan, down Lake Huron, Lake Erie, to the Erie Canal, across New York to Albany, down the Hudson River to New York City, and out across the Atlantic.
And never touch ground.
And never touch ground.
Well, before we go any further, I'm going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about this body of water that is so large and yet so small and so packed with history. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and our guest is Bob Myers, who is now at the Historical Society of Michigan, but was originally, his first job was with the Historical Society of Berrien County. This is John Smetanka, as I said, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. Back on With Respect with our guest this week is Bob Myers, who is now with the Historical Society of Michigan and has ties to southwestern Michigan and Berrien County, its Historical Society. This is John Smetanka. So, Bob, when we broke, we started talking about this great body of water and how you can go so far around the world by just staying on the water highway. So, how does this trace back in our history? Do we have historical contacts going far back?
Oh yeah, for hundreds and hundreds of years. Of course, the Native Americans used the lakes for fishing. Their watercraft were birch bark canoes, and the Northern Great Lakes dug out canoes down around Berrien County. But it was a water highway for Native Americans, and I've always been amazed at how they would travel. Of course, they were masters of that kind of watercraft, and they thought nothing of traveling hundreds of miles. You know, you and I would think, oh my gosh, you can't go that far with a canoe. But I've always loved the story. It's a little bit later, but 1750, the Pottawatomi in southwest Michigan heard that there was a new governor general in Montreal, French governor general. And so they decided, we're going to go pay him a visit. And so they just hopped in canoes and away they went. And they traveled all the way to Montreal and back. And they thought nothing of making these enormously long voyages by canoe.
How long would a trip like that take by canoe?
Oh gosh, yeah, I should look it up sometime. It would be a journey of several weeks, even for expert paddlers. Mm-hmm. And of course, it depended on whether you were going with or against the current. The French adopted the birch bark canoes too. They built up to close to 40-foot long canoes. They'd haul about 2.5-3 tons of freight in one of those canoes, and they rigged them up with a sail, a canvas sail. So if they had good conditions and so forth, they'd raise a sail in the canoe, and they would sail the thing. But they were the semi trucks of the 18th, 17th and 18th centuries. Just amazing watercraft.
Well, one of the areas that we in southwestern Michigan are in love with, I think, is the St. Joseph River and how it formed a part of a waterway even going the other way, that is, going away from Great Lakes and going elsewhere down to the, well, close to the Mississippi, right?
Yeah, yeah. That was the thing. You could go the other way too, like you say. I would ask people, well, how far could you travel by water, you know, kind of going south? And basically, the answer was New Orleans. You could go to the Gulf of Mexico. And what you did and what people did do was they would ascend the St. Joseph River, and then they would take the Kankakee Portage from kind of around South Bend, and it led into the Kankakee River, which went into the Illinois River, which went into the Mississippi River, and then you go all the way down to New Orleans. And so in the 18th century, the French are building their North American empire. And so they have the Southern Great Lakes region linked with Louisiana. So it's a huge commercial highway both ways.
What's this? They talk about an empire. You talk about the French Empire. Give us a kind of a brief pastiche of this empire building between the British and the French and the Americans. How did that take place?
Yeah, those were the superpowers of the 17th and 18th century. Spain, France, Great Britain, they were the superpowers. And as they come into North America, of course, you know, there are Native Americans here, but they didn't particularly care too much about that in a way. And so they start carving up North America. And the French have what's Canada and about two-thirds of the continental United States from the Appalachian Mountains west. The English, of course, along the Atlantic sea coast, Spain farther south. So they're building their empires here. They're one of the things that they were hoping to do, the French and the English, was duplicate the success of Spain. The Spanish, of course, had found enormous wealth in gold and silver, which they plundered. But it helped make Spain a superpower. That's what funded the famous Spanish Armada, was the gold and silver from Central and South America. French and the English, they don't find too much gold and silver, but they do. The French particularly find furs. Other things, but especially fur. And so they build a fur trading empire. But they're also, the French are also very concerned with converting the Native Americans. And so they send missionaries into the French Empire. And they took that very, very seriously. In fact, so much so that if a Native American converted to Roman Catholicism, they became a French citizen. They had all the rights of a French citizen. So, of course, the Native Americans really had their own religion and spiritual beliefs. So the success was a little bit limited that way from the French point of view. But they're building, these European powers are building great empires in North America, Central America, South America.
Now I've heard about the French missionaries, and we know something about them. We know about a few of them by name. One of them that I recall is Father Marquette. He was one of those pioneers, wasn't he?
Yeah, Jacques Marquette. Alloway. Of course, I try to think of them, and I have a senior moment. Dablon. But yeah, these Jesuit missionaries who are traveling and they're exploring the region. They're mapping the region, and then trying their best to save souls, as they would put it.
Yeah, and they started missions, that is, places where this conversion process could be based. Some of those were in the Great Lakes area, weren't they?
Oh yeah, all through the Great Lakes. Uh, 1640, something like that, and it's showing it was drawn to show the location of the Jesuit missions that were scattered throughout the Great Lakes, even at that time.
One of those was in St. Joseph, or a place in St. Joseph was a place of landing, wasn't it, for Marquette?
Yeah, he probably came up the, in 1675, came up the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. He was dying at that time, and in fact, died probably where Ludington is today.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the things that they were kind of embracing was martyrdom. They hoped to be martyred for the church.
And were they?
And many of them were. Many of them succeeded in that. But they saw the suffering as. Equating with hearkening to Jesus's suffering for salvation. I remember reading of one of the missionaries who wrote that he had trouble writing because the natives had cut off most of his fingers, and it was sort of a source of pride that he had suffered so much.
Now, they moved around on the water, whether it's by canoe or elsewhere, but my recollection, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was a settlement set up originally by the French, and then later on was taken over or reestablished by the British, around the mouth of the St. Joseph River. Was it Fort Miami that was there?
Yeah, that was Fort Miami. That was the French fur trader, explorer, René Robert Cavelier, Sieur de La Salle. Our kids' history books, we remember him as La Salle. And this was one of his fur trading posts that he set up. It was really more a warehouse than a real post, but... But he had arrived there in 1679, and he built this post. Right? He had his men build it while he was awaiting some reinforcements, and he had enough brains to know that you didn't go into the Native American country without having a good number of men. You needed a show of force, and. But his men were not inclined to stick around with him. Nobody really liked him much. About the only people that liked La Salle were the people that soon didn't. And so he was afraid that his men would all desert. So they arrived at the mouth of the St. Joseph River first of November, 1679. So he was afraid his men would all run off and leave him while he waited for reinforcements. And so he put them to work, keep them busy and keep them distracted. And they build this small post there that he dubbed Fort Miami. And he used it for about 3 years. Some of his own deserters burned it down a year later. But then he rebuilt it, used it until I think the last time was 1682. And then it was abandoned.
Now, how did they get in those days? Were the Great Lakes themselves important in the establishment and maintenance of these posts and missions and whatnot?
Oh yeah, that was how you got there. That was how you kept them supplied. That was how soldiers and fur traders would arrive at the post. That was how they brought all of their goods in for trade. And the fur trade and the military and the church, the missionaries, were all kind of interconnected. Having soldiers there showed the flag. It kept it provided protection for the fur traders. The fur traders brought in goods that supplied the soldiers and the missionaries. The missionaries provided intelligence information to the soldiers, and had protection from the soldiers. So it was all interrelated, and the lakes were absolutely crucial to that.
We're going to take a break right now, but we're going to be talking when we get back. I'm going to tease you, Bob, and the audience, with one of the first mysteries we're going to be talking about as far as ships on the Great Lakes, and it's called the Griffin. So this is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we're talking to Bob Myers of the Historical Society of Michigan. We're talking to him about the magnificent bodies of water that we have around us in Michigan that make us the Great Lakes State. We'll be right back. This is John Smetanka. Back on With Respect with Bob Myers of the Historical Society of Michigan, and has connections here with Berrien County in southwestern Michigan, but is now dealing with the history of the entire state of Michigan, which goes back many centuries. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. Now, Bob, when we broke, I teased it with the first wreck that we're going to be talking about, or the first boat we're going to be talking about in particular, is the Griffin. Tell me about that. This is a famous boat, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. LaSalle's Griffin was built near Niagara Falls in 1679. And we really don't know a whole lot about the Griffin. It was probably a bark, and it was probably about 45 tons. That's the accounts vary as to exactly how it was rigged and how large it was, but something like that. And
what is a bark?
A bark is, I've got to remember, it's a vessel with a sailing vessel, of course. Three or four masts. It's a square rigger. And rigged, the mizzen mast, the aftmost mast is rigged fore and aft. But nobody really knows for sure if it was a bark. That's kind of the supposition, but of course the accounts do vary.
Now, that bark, that the ship, whatever it was, it was the first of a kind. And what do you mean by the first of a kind? I know that it was.
Apparently the first sailing vessel on the Great Lakes proper. You can haul a lot of freight in a ship, even a small one, like the Griffin. And LaSalle was very keen on building the fur trade and getting rich. He worked night and day for the greater honor and glory of LaSalle. and and his own fortunes, which got him in trouble with the French government because he didn't want him to do that. He was not supposed to be fur trading. They were trying to put a crimp on the fur trading, and yet he insisted on doing that. And but he builds the Griffin again. It was right near built it near Niagara Falls, and then long story short, takes it that summer of 1679 into the Great Lakes, and had a crew of about 30 men, 30, 35 men, something like that, and went from Lake Erie to Lake Huron, and then across Lake Michigan, which was an area that, you know, they'd never seen a sailing ship before. This was a first.
Mm-hmm. And did it make it? Where was it going? And where did and what? Why is it a mystery ship?
Yeah, it was bound for we would now say Green Bay, Wisconsin, and arrived, picked up a load of furs. And then LaSalle ordered the crew to, I think it was a crew of about six that were handling the ship. And he ordered them to go back east, take the furs back, and then they would come with goods and so forth and come down Lake Michigan, and it would meet him at Fort Miami at the mouth of the St. Joseph River. And so the Griffin departed, headed east. LaSalle and his party of men then came down Lake Michigan and stopped at the mouth of the river. That's where they built the Fort Miami we talked about. And they awaited the Griffin, and it never returned. And to this day, no one knows what happened to the Griffin. The story that I buy is that it went down in a storm. We know that there was a major storm just a day or two after it departed, I think, from what's now Wisconsin. And we all know about Lake Michigan storms and how terrible they can be. And they've taken down huge steel freighters, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. And so a small vessel like that, who knows? But there were allegations that some of LaSalle's deserters might have sunk the ship, that Native Americans might have attacked it. I think LaSalle himself believed that his own men scuttled the Griffin and took off with the goods, but there's really no documentation for that either. But it disappeared without a trace, and to this day we just don't know what happened to it.
It sort of left the de LaSalle, who is waiting back at the St. Joe River, alone. He was kind of marooned, as it were, wasn't he?
Yeah, he finally did receive some reinforcements. His lieutenant, Henry de Tonty, arrived with more men, and then they pushed on up the St. Joseph River and ultimately down the Mississippi. But of course, he'd lost the Griffin and the load of furs and so forth.
Now, we could talk for days, I'm sure, about all the different fascinating wrecks and disappearances of ships or whatever on the Great Lakes. In fact, there's one great story. It's written in a book by a woman who has been on our show about the Northwest Airlines flight, which disappeared in the 50s, over Lake Michigan, has never been found, or maybe possibly has been found now. But people were looking for these wrecks. How many wrecks are there out there? Do you have any idea?
It's a good question. And the answer is nobody really knows. Historians have documented, I think, around I'm going to say around 5,500 commercial ships on the Great Lakes that that are wrecked. Now, that's anything from a 40 or 50 foot commercial fishing boat on up to 800 foot ore freighters. But we're not talking about canoes and yachts and rowboats and things like that. These are all commercial vessels. And so probably around at least around 5,500, but the estimates go up to about 10,000.
My distant uncle was a captain on one of the lake ships, freighters. But before that, he had sailed on the Murmansk run from, I think it was Britain, up to the Russian city of Murmansk. And during the Second World War, and of course that's a notoriously difficult run, both because they were going to be attacked, but also because of the weather. But he was the legend in our family was he was said that after the war he went on to the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, in one of those steel boats you talk about. And he said that it was more difficult sailing, more dangerous sailing on the Great Lakes than it was on the Atlantic in terms of weather, which I thought was remarkable. But the point he made was that the configuration of the lakes and the strong breezes, winds that can come through, and the storms that can come up quickly can make a very perilous trip. The poor old Griffin however few feet it was child's play to some of these storms as far as knocking them out, taking them down.
Yeah, the lakes, he would have been right. The lakes, of course, are relatively shallow. They're a few hundred feet deep instead of a couple of miles deep. And so when you get these winds coming across the lake, and you can get winds of up to 90 miles an hour or thereabouts, and then you get the chop, kind of instead of the huge swells, you get these you get this chop. And so you think, well, but you're really only a few dozen miles from shore at the most. And yeah, but with that kind of weather conditions, and it can turn bad so quickly that it just overwhelmed these ships.
Well, I've heard tell that in Lake Michigan, for example, they've had waves recorded upwards of 40 feet, which are fairly, those are big waves. We put out storm warnings and beach warnings if the waves are 10 feet. But there's some major storms out there in the middle of the lakes that can take a ship down, as the record of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which is a famous song, was based on the sinking in Lake Superior of a large ore boat that sunk. It was the pride of the American side, as the song goes. But at any rate, this danger, these dangers that the water and the waves and the wind can cause for shipping has produced some fascinating mystical stories. And one of them I'd like to chat with you about is the one that I kind of grew up with, listening, looking about different wrecks and how interesting they were, because I might wanted to go diving on it, was the famous Chicora. And that was, I know you've talked about the Chicora in its history, but I'll tell you, I thought I learned that this ship was sunk, and it had $50,000 worth of gold specie, they said. And I thought, oh, I got to dive on that ship because it's supposed to be right next to St. Joseph or South Haven. I thought, I can get this ship, all right? Well, tell me about the Chicora.
Yeah, no gold on board, unfortunately. Flour was the cargo. But yeah, Chicora was a new vessel. It was about just a hair over 200 feet long. It was built for the Graham and Morton Transportation Company, which is a Benton Harbor company, and built at Detroit Dry Dock, one of the big shipbuilding outfits, in 1892. And she was built for running across Lake Michigan from Benton Harbor over to Chicago and Milwaukee. I think she made about two-thirds of her trips to Chicago and about one-third to Milwaukee. And she was built for carrying passengers and package freight. So things like, you know, flour or, you know, bags of flour and furniture and things like that. So she wasn't hauling lumber, coal, iron ore, things like that. It was passengers and package freight. And but really a magnificent vessel, mahogany woodwork. You really traveled in style on these things. And but the shipping companies would stop running in the winter, usually right around the 1st of January, late December, early January, mid-January. The lake would ice up, the harbors would ice up, and they couldn't run anymore. And insurance companies would not insure the ships after November because of the weather conditions. Well, Chicora had a very successful career for a couple of years. In the winter of 1894, early January, actually, of 1895, Graham and Morton kind of put the ship into storage. They docked it in Benton Harbor, and they took all the furniture out and the carpets and all that kind of thing. And you know, they would spend the winter doing repair work and maintenance. Well, mid-January, toward the end of January, they get a call from the one of their big clients. It was called the Big Four Railroad. And the railroad owner said, we've got a big cargo of flour in Milwaukee, and we need it picked up and brought across the lake. And would you put the Chicora on the lake one more time?
Okay, before we go any further, I've got to take a break. But now, okay, when we come back, we're going to be talking about what happened to this very efficient and wonderful ship when they made the January run from Milwaukee to somewhere. This is John's Matanka Run. With respect, we're talking to Bob Myers of the Historical Society of Michigan and formerly of the Berrien County Historical Society. This is John's Matanka, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Bob Myers, who is the historian of Berrien County for a good number of years, but is now with the Historical Society of Michigan, a very ancient organization that has done a lot of good work and has, we're going to talk a little bit about its magazine and how accessible it is to people who are interested in following up on this show. So, this is John's Matanka. So, Bob, it's January. It's cold in Michigan, and the ice is starting to form out there in the lake. And then there's the ship, the Chicora, which has been requisitioned or asked for by a shipping company on the, a train company on the other side of the lake. Make one more trip. What happened?
Yeah, well, they tell him, Graham and Morton says, yeah, we'll put the ship out, the boat out on the lake one more time. and they round up the crew. They had scattered to their homes for the winter, but they round up the crew and they steam out of Benton Harbor. And it's unseasonably warm. It's a, they have a nice warm day for the trip across. The lake hasn't frozen up or not too badly, some slush ice. But they get over to Milwaukee, load up the flour, and they head back across Lake Michigan to Benton Harbor. And a tremendous storm blew up. The barometer just plunged, the temperatures plunged, and this huge storm blew up. And the ship simply vanished. This is just a few years before radio, so they have no radio set on the ship, on the boat. And the Chicora just vanishes. And they, of course, at first she's delayed. And then reports come in that debris is washing up along the lake, I think most of it around Holland. And but the people still held out hope. They because sometimes a ship would be the upper works would be torn off in a storm, and a couple of days later she'd come limping into port. So they hoped that something had happened and she was still afloat. And but they're fearing the worst. And then the people in St. Joseph, and most of the crew was from St. Joseph Benton Harbor. And they get word that the Chicora has been seen. The hull is overturned. It's down by at the southern, really the southern tip of Lake Michigan. But the hull is overturned. But there are men walking around on the hull, and people are just overjoyed. So Graham and Morton immediately they hire a steam train, a special train to go down. John Graham went with it, the owner, president of Graham and Morton. And he gets down there, and they look out across the lake with field glasses, and what they see are windrows of ice that people had mistaken for a hull, and seagulls on it.
Oh no!
And of course, people are devastated, just devastated. And to this day, nobody knows exactly what happened to Chicora. There were all kinds of stories of people who said that in the middle of the storm they were out, they could hear the ship's whistle out on the lake. Some people claim to have seen it. That may or may not be true. I don't put a whole lot of credence with the stories. People tended to exaggerate to be charitable about it. But it vanished. There were 25 passengers and or crewmen and one passenger on it, a pharmacist from Benton Harbor, and they were all lost. No bodies were ever recovered. Often bodies would wash up a few days or weeks later. That never happened, and she was simply gone. And the galling thing, I guess, is that the railroad that had asked them to put the boat out on the lake for one more run contacted Graham and Morton and said, "Well, you owe us for the flour."
Oh Lord!
And they paid. They paid them. But the ship was gone, and they had no insurance on it. So they had not only the loss of the crew, but the loss of the value of the flour and the loss of the vessel, because they couldn't get insurance in the winter. So it was a staggering blow for the Graham and Morton Company.
Did they ever find it? Has it ever been found?
Well, yes and no. Maybe. How about that?
All right.
Probably a lot of our listeners have heard about the company. It's called A&T Recovery, and they've been going out on Lake Michigan for quite a few years now, and they have been locating and recovering World War II aircraft that are on the bottom of the lake. And so to find these aircraft, they go along, they have a side scan sonar, and they do what's called lawn mowing, and they just go back and forth along the lake, and they look for airplanes, and occasionally they find ships. Well, two or three years ago, they were mowing the lawn out in Lake Michigan, and they found the wreck of a large steamer, about 200 feet long, pretty much intact, one smokestack, which also fits the, so it fits the size of the Chicora, the length of it, and the Chicora was just one stack. And that's about the only known vessel of that configuration that could be out there. And she's fairly deep, but located right about, I'm told, right about where the state border lines out in the lake converge of Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan. So about the center of the lake out there. And it's just going to take somebody to go down with a submersible camera and take a good look at it and determine if that is the Chicora. But I think it probably is.
Talking about recovering wrecks, and we just have a short period of time left in our show, unfortunately. But another very famous wreck is we talked about briefly before, which is the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, about which the Gordon, I think it was Gordon Lightfoot, wrote this ballad, which is, ironically, I've heard this ballad played in pubs and places all over the Western world. I've heard it in France and Italy, for example. But
wow.
But at any rate, that was a fascinating wreck. But they lost 29 people in that wreck. But they found that ship, and they have taken pictures of it, right?
Yeah. The wreck was located just a few days after the loss of the ship in Lake Superior, and to this day, nobody knows exactly what happened. Of course, it was a tremendous storm. There are various theories as to why the Fitzgerald went down. One of the crew from St. Joseph, Tom Benson, was an oiler on the Fitzgerald. In fact, my wife went to school with him. He was two or three years ahead of her in school, but she knew him. And a tremendous tragedy. But this
leads into the last two points that I think we can cover here, and that is, there is, and I'm sure, I hope that you've seen it, a museum up on the Upper Peninsula at Whitefish Bay, where the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, which highlights shipwrecks on the Great Lakes, the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum. And I've been up there, and it's a very, very interesting place, talking about those things, those events that we have talked about, and many, many more. So have you been up there?
Oh, yes. It's a great location and a tremendous museum, as you know. It's just wonderful.
It's worth a trip to that museum. It's a bit out of the way on the shores of Lake Superior, but it's a fascinating ambiance and historical collection of stories and events and models and whatnot. I loved it. I thought it was great. But the other thing I want to talk about is, you raised a point earlier about the Historical Society of Michigan puts out a magazine. And what's in that magazine, and how can any of our listeners who want to get it, how can they find it?
Yeah, well, they can go right to our website, which is hsmichigan.org. And we have a publications section there, and they can subscribe to the magazine and or they can join the Historical Society of Michigan. And if they join the Historical Society of Michigan, the magazine comes with it. We also publish a members magazine called Chronicle, and that comes out quarterly. Michigan History Magazine is bi-monthly. And I think our editorial staff does a great job with it. I don't have much to do with it, which is why it's a good magazine, I think. But But it's a, it is a, they do a wonderful job, and they really work hard to cover all aspects of Michigan's history. And so, you know, it's the good, bad, and the ugly. They cover all different time periods from the colonial period on up into the 1970s. They try to cover a wide geographic range. They try to cover, you know, women's history, not all dead white guys. We cover, you know, women's history and people of color and Native Americans, African Americans, just everything that we can, because, you know, that's all a part of history. And so I think they do a great job.
One last time, how do we find that magazine? You're a not-for-profit organization, right?
Yes, we are. We are a nonprofit. Yep.
All right, and the place to your website is
HS, as in Historical Society, but just hsmichigan.org.
All right, Bob Myers, thank you very much. It's been a delight talking to you about historical Michigan and the relationship we have to the water around us.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's so good to talk with you again. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Not a problem, Bob. Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen of our audience, remember, we are on every Sunday and Thursday. And until next time, remember our mantra: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you. Thank you.